somehow they split up.
All right, we'll call to order the Housing Committee, or Housing Committee, the House Committee.
I'm in the wrong room.
Yeah, exactly. House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. And we're welcome our visitors, and we're welcoming our representatives. So welcome back for a short time. All right, it's Wednesday, September 21st, 2016, and we have a simple agenda, but I think it'll be interesting. So first of all, we're going to hear from the folks on Open Educational Resources Grant Program Update. Then we'll hear about the Oregon Promise, then healthcare, workforce gaps in Southern Oregon, and finally promoting success for former foster youth. So we'll just go ahead and get started with Mr. Cannon and Teresa Wolf and Betsy Simkin. So we'll open an information hearing on the open educational resource.
Thank you, Chair Gallegos, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And I'm joined by two of our staff, Teresa Wolf and Betsy Simpkins. Teresa fills the position that you created to support the OER grant program and other OER work. And Betsy is in our Office of Research and Data and is also helping to support and evaluate the program. So I will turn it over to Teresa to provide the gist of the presentation. Betsy and I are here primarily to answer questions related to the funding or the future of the program. But Teresa's been in the weeds working with the faculty and the institutions and developing the materials and supporting their ongoing use. And I'll turn it over to her to share that work with you.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Gallegos, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Wolf, and I am the OER Policy Specialist at the HEC. So in this update, I'll focus on the progress associated with HB 2871, specifically regarding two key components of the bill, one being the grant program, and two, the requirement for OER designation. So HEC developed the grant program approximating $395,000 to fund public post-secondary institutions to create, adapt, and modify existing OER for 15 identified courses that are high enrollment and transferable among the institutions. So shown here are the 15 identified courses. Most are general education courses, which often have high-cost textbooks. Some of the disciplines, like biology and math, consist of more than one course or course series for which an OER was developed, or for which an OER grant was offered. So this is a brief timeline of the grant program work to date. The request for applications went out in April through a competitive bid process, and the chosen awardees were notified at the end of June. Grant contracts were finalized and distributed at the end of August, and all of the OER work is expected to be completed by June 30th, 2017, when the bill sunsets. There are five public universities and five community colleges who receive grant awards, and they are working with an additional eight institutions to produce OER. So these collaborative efforts constitute 18 out of our 24 public institutions of higher education working to generate OER for Oregon students. And I apologize, this slide should say 18 public Oregon institutions, not 17. So of the 15 possible grant awards, two have not yet been awarded, and they are listed here. HEC is actively soliciting for these open opportunities. The other key component of the bill, Section 4, requires public post-secondary institutions to prominently designate courses that exclusively use open, free, or low-cost educational materials. So we expect more institutions to be adapting their own representations for designation as more OER are developed. So these are just some great examples of the public institutions, of the designations that public institutions are using in their course catalogs. So for example, each of these institutions has incorporated a logo to identify an OER course. Blue Mountain is also using a separate designation for courses that use low-cost materials, but this is not a requirement. As institutions consider promotion options for their courses, the HEC is encouraging them to collaborate with others to develop and use existing graphics and narratives. As the open education specialist, my work is focused on building the OER capacity around the state. I work closely with our public institutions of higher ed to promote and create awareness of open education resources. These efforts include on-site visits, presentations, and connecting with institutional partners with other OER enthusiasts across the state. In addition, I collaborate with a variety of OER specialists and other state governmental partners who are working on similar OER initiatives. Currently, there are 20 out of our 24 public post-secondary institutions in Oregon using some form of open education resources in their courses. This includes those that were awarded the HEC grants. The OER being used goes beyond general education courses, including a wide range of subjects such as nursing, art history, and health science. The OER page on the HEC website has been significantly updated to include the grant awardees, information about OER, and links to webinars and other resources. As the grant program OER work is completed, the final products will be showcased here and can be downloaded for use by anyone, anywhere. So lastly, the next steps for this work through June 30th, 2017 include consideration of a state OER repository, development of a symposium for the grant awardees next spring, and continuing outreach and extension work to promote OER awareness and use across the state. And with that, we'd like to thank Chair Gallegos and members of the committee for your time, and we are happy to answer any questions.
Representative Wisnik.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. I was the state representative and attended some of the early meetings. Very excited. This whole committee is very excited about this project. We employed the two of you. Is that the total number of FTEs that we hired for this grant? And how long are they temporary? Are they permanent? Mm-hmm.
Chair Wisnik, members of the committee, yes. So you are looking at our OER. It's not all of Betsy's time, I believe, but it is all of Teresa's time. One of them may be able to provide the exact number of FTE, but it's around one FTE, I believe, that was associated with the bill. They'll correct me. And these were the OER specific FTE is limited duration, so one-time dollars. As adopted in the 2015 budget.
And Director Cannon, thank you for getting involved in the conversation. It's my understanding you did not submit this for your next budget. Is that correct? Continuation of this program?
Chair Gallegos, Representative Wisnett, the HECS agency request budget is based really on a CSL budget that doesn't include limited duration positions continuing, but we're happy to work with the legislature, with the governor, with others to consider ways in which to support this work on an ongoing basis. But no, it is not in our official agency request budget. It could, of course, be in the governor's budget or in the legislatively adopted budget.
Continue.
Yes.
Thank you. Could you give me more details about the on the page, whatever it was here, the statewide OER initiative? You said 20 of the 24 public universities are using some form of OER. Could you please expand on what are they using? Was that part of the grant process? Did some of the grant money go for that?
Yes. Chair Gallegos, Representative Wisnett, this does include the HEC grant awards, so that was a wide range of those 15 subjects that you saw on that previous page. So I've identified 20 of our 24 public institutions that are using either textbooks for complete OER and, you know, exclusively in courses, or they're using some form of OER, which could be activities, or it could be videos, it could be portions. So the reason that I highlighted this is because I think it's a really good showing of how involved our institutions are starting to become.
Because I think for the I think for the committee's information, because that was one of the things early on, we just tried to decide what was the intent of the legislation. In order to, was it to buy a complete book, or, you know, all the textbook, or could you buy something with it to supplement? I tried to voice your opinion on the legislation, but I sort of stayed away and let the professionals, because I think the key to the success of this program is buy-in by the professors and the department heads of our public universities. So they did, you know, instead of just using a textbook, as she explained, it was part of the curriculum. So I think that's still acceptable for what we were wanting, the more, you know, so you don't, the students don't. Our intent was to save students money. So they wouldn't fuss at Representative Johnson about not a completely free promise. I get away there. Can I continue?
Yes, please. It's like you have a full set there.
Do you have coffee today?
And I think it was a really accomplishment to get the steering committee. My concern is we have the steering committee. We have people working now, and we've got a product that we achieved. I don't want the steering committee to go away. I'd like to work with the HEC, and this committee could work with the HEC to see if we can come up with some legislation to continue the steering committee. I think the steering committee should look at what we've done here, and someone that should be part of the bill for the continuing the steering committee, and a little bit of work for the HEC to continue to see the progress we can make and what we've done here. Is that the right decision, the right way to go? That would be my recommendation, Mr. Chair, that we, this committee, look and work with the HEC in trying to draft some legislation, at least continue the steering committee, and see if we're ready to ask for more money, for more grants, to add more textbooks at this time. But
Okay. Representative.
Yeah, I'm just, if you could help me understand a little bit, I saw the presentation, but in terms of the marketing, if you will, of this program, how many products are available? It looks like just a few of the institutions so far. And how is the word getting out to students so that they know that, would they be using this information, for example, in their decision to attend one school or another? I mean, is there a significant cost difference? I know there are some online cost analysis programs that students can use or for selecting a school. Is this type of information on those programs? Anything you can fill in on that? I'm just curious about it.
Chair Gallegos, Representative Reardon. Yes, so that is actually, I think part of your question is addressed in Section 4 of the bill, which requires designation for courses that exclusively use OER or open or low-cost mm-hmm. materials. So in the in these examples here that I show, these schools specifically have these icons designated in their course catalogs to identify the courses that exclusively use OER. So this is about giving students a choice. So when they go to the course catalog to register for a course, they see that this course uses an OER that either doesn't cost them any money or, in Blue Mountain's case, costs less than $40. In terms of outreach to students, each of the institutions are developing their own sort of guide and policies around how they get the word out to students. However, I know a lot of students are already very aware of OER and its existence, and I've actually participated with students at some of the institutions, and they've held OER festivals. So they've had campus-wide festivals where they've had, you know, they've brought in and shown what OER looks like. They've done games. They've done a lot of speaking around it. So that was actually a really positive thing.
That's exciting.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative McEwen, you had a question.
Thank you, Chair Gallegos. This is very exciting, what you're doing, and I know this committee has been very enthusiastic about this rollout, and it's so new. I'm sure you don't have participation rate information for us at this point in time, or do you have any sense of what the participation rate might be as this thing's rolled out in the first year?
Chair Gallegos, Representative McEwen, don't have definite numbers of participation, but I mean, we do have the numbers that I showed from here from our grant awards. So we have 10 schools total with an additional 8. So we have 17 out of our 24 institutions that are already starting to work on OER.
And the other question I have is, you know, it's new. This is very innovative, or it's fairly cutting edge. What obstacles are you finding that you're running into that are creating problems for you?
Chair Gallegos, Representative Kuhn. Barriers, well, you know, it is difficult. I mean, faculty are pressed for time and resources. So, you know, one of the barriers is just being able to, you know, outreach to faculty and, you know, not feel like, you know, you're constantly pressing them for time. There is a lot of materials out there, so sorting through those materials, I think that's probably one of the biggest barriers for faculty, is you can find a plethora of OER out there in existence on the web, but the quality of the materials varies widely. And so one of the things that I've really been working with faculty that have approached me is helping them find resources and helping them find quality resources, because that does take a lot of time.
Sure.
Chair Gallegos, Representative McEwen, if I might suggest that Betsy Simpkins describe some of our projections around the number of students who may be served through the OER work that we're doing.
Chair Gallegos, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Simpkins with the HEC, Office of Research and Data. And so my role with this program is to manage the grant and kind of watch the money and track the progress of the proposals. So what I can give you is a little bit of of a sense of the impact we expect this round of grants to have. We asked the grantees or potential grantees to estimate how many students are in each course that they're proposing to develop an OER for, and what the average cost of the textbook for that course is. So currently, with the 10 institutions that have been awarded grant funds, five community colleges, five universities. I have individual numbers, but I'll give you just the totals for now, and you can follow up if you need to. So it's looking like, and these are estimates, approximately given the courses that were awarded, 13,209 students annually. And that equates to about $1.7 million in cost savings to students every year.
Repeat the number, please.
The full number is $1,772,116.60. that's on an annual basis, given that these are general education courses that are typically taken every year for at community college and university students. This is what they would save by not having to purchase textbooks at the average cost that is the current going rate. So that, we believe that's a significant impact on students on an annual basis.
Ms. Simpkins, so that's what's happened in the past year, that's your projection for next year?
This is what we anticipate.
This is your projection.
As of June 30, 2017.
Okay, thank you.
Of these OER will be rolled out for the following fall term, and generally the institutions indicate that they are going to offer this OER in those courses every term following their initial rollout. So these numbers are based on estimates of their current enrollment for those specific courses and the average textbook currently.
Thank you.
You want to get your questions in, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Thank you both, Teresa and Betsy, for your work on this. As was stated earlier, I think next to the Oregon Promise, I think this bill or that bill, I think, was the one that generated the most excitement about what we can do to reduce student debt and just the cost of post-secondary. And I always want to go back and reference that number, that $1.7 million in savings. I mean, that's amazing. But that would pale into significance of what it would be if, you know, we had all 15 courses available across the board at all 24 institutions. Mm-hmm. This would be just a drop in the bucket. So I think that shows what could be accomplished. But I guess my question's about going forward. Yes, there was the $350,000 that was attributed to this, but I really think it's, you know, this committee, I think, would support, and I think the entire legislature would support an ongoing effort. So I guess as we go forward, it gets back to the question that was addressed to Director Cannon. Could you perhaps put together what would it take to keep you on the job and to keep this work going forward for the next biennium, and what would it take to get to where we have all 15 courses available at all 24 institutions? What kind of timeline would we look like having to be able to implement that? What would it take, you know, just if we had to fund that and make that a part of the ongoing HEC budget? I'd like to know that, because I really think that's where we're at. I mean, I think there's a commitment amongst, like I said, I think this committee and I think the entire legislature to get this done, because I think it's so valuable and so important. So let you guys comment.
Representative Johnson, Chair Gallegos, we'd be very happy to work with you on that. I think as this presentation suggested, there are a few aspects of the work that would benefit significantly from ongoing support from the legislature and potentially the HEC, including maintaining the repository itself. There is it's certainly our intent that even if there isn't ongoing funding, that we'll find a home for the materials that doesn't depend on ongoing appropriations. But there are costs even to maintaining sort of a house, a home for the materials themselves. Working with faculty to ensure that they're updated and maintain the materials themselves are updated and maintained. And then, as Teresa also suggested, the continuing outreach to faculty, to administrators, to students, to ensure that the materials don't only exist but are used. And so even apart from any additional grants for new course build-out, which, of course, is also possible, there are certainly opportunities for us to support the work on an ongoing basis in some meaningful ways. So I think we'd be, I know we'd be very happy to work with the committee
Great.
On that.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assumed, which is a mistake, I know, that all these courses are transferable to the four-year school or part of the OSU. Is that correct?
Chair Gallegos, Representative Wisnett, yes, that is correct.
Okay, great. Second is I hope that the HEC will be sure that OSA knows what we've done here and what you've done, and that their students continue to push this body and everyone for growing this program. The students, I see that they're represented in the room, and that's impressive, I think, what we've done. I think we're all going to be proud, but it's what we're all trying to do is make college more affordable for everyone. So thank you.
Chair Gallegos.
Yes.
I'm not seeing it in the presentation. If I missed it, I apologize. It would be interesting for me to see a list of the schools that are participating. Are they on the last page? What? No, I'm...
You have to go to the HEC website.
Oh, I think I found it.
Chair Gallegos, Representative McCune, on the HEC's website, we do have a list of all of the schools right now that were awarded HEC grants and that are participating.
Okay. That's very small print. Isn't it listed
right.
there?
I didn't intend. Sorry, I apologize. I didn't intend for anybody to actually read it. I just wanted it as a representation that you could go to.
Okay.
And take
thank you.
Well, thank you so much. This is really, as was said, a very important program. I do have a couple of questions. And I'm, you know, I think about 40-40-20 all the time. You know, how are we going to get there? So I think the evaluation questions are really critical. You know, how much, as you said, how much are we saving the students, for one thing? I mean, a student can anticipate spending well over $500 for one quarter for books. I mean, it's just... The other thing, though, is not just then the cost saving to students, but then, as you point out, the quality of the materials. How do we sort of regulate and monitor that? You know, the other question that came to me was, you know, implementing this, we're also sort of changing the culture. We're changing the culture of academia. And how does that relate then, as we talk about faculty, getting faculty to buy into this program, how does it then benefit or detract from faculty kind of tenure issues, for example, the standard being publication and peer-reviewed materials, journals, and so on. And if faculty publish this way, how does that stack up in terms of those kinds of decisions? So that, you know, that's something I think we need to sort of think about as we proceed with this program. And I don't know what your evaluation program has in mind in terms of looking at all these variables, but it seems to me that those are some of the things. So it's not just the economy, but also the quality and then the impact on the whole system. I think that I had another question, too. When you mentioned that these materials are free to anyone, we have a number of students here from Pacific University, a private institution, and we can appreciate how important our private institutions are in achieving our 40-40-20. So are these materials available to our private university students as well, I guess, is part of my question.
Chair Gallegos, yes, that is correct.
So they're available as well, so that's helpful to know. And again, I would think about how do we evaluate then the impact even on our private institutions. So those would be the questions that I would have, and I'm sure that the steering committee, and as you monitor, you'll think about these kinds of questions as well. So thank you very much. I think we're done with questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the session hearing on
one of the best things we did.
I think so too.
On educational resources, and open a hearing on the Oregon Promise. Mr. Cannon is up again.
Chair Gallegos, members of the committee, again for the record, Ben Cannon, executive director for the HAC, and I was invited to present an update to the committee on implementation of the Oregon Promise. I want to sort of steal my own thunder right at the outset by saying that because the fall term has not yet begun at community colleges, and because enrollment numbers aren't sort of complete until the fourth week of the term, we don't sort of officially know how many students have enrolled. I cannot and will not today provide you with hard and fast data about the number of students who will participate in the program this fall or, of course, in the winter or spring. That said, I will attempt to update you on our progress in implementation and respond to questions that you may have. And we are certainly, as the term draws nearer, we're certainly getting a clearer sense of the program and how it will look on campuses starting next week. So just first with some background information, and I know with this committee in particular, I can move very quickly through this. Senate Bill 81 created the program. It's a state-funded grant program that covers the last dollars towards tuition at community college after federal and other state grants are considered. It begins to be available to students in this academic year, 2016-17, and it's administered by the HEC's Office of Student Access and Completion. We have several of the staff who are leading that implementation here in the room, Peggy Cooksey and Colin Ellis from OSAC. Bob Brew is on medical leave this month, or he would be joining us today. So student eligibility criteria, again, to walk just very quickly through the program for folks who are hearing about it for the first time, which I know doesn't include any member of the committee, but others who may be listening. Students must be Oregon residents. They must complete an application as well as a FAFSA. They must submit high school transcripts indicating a high school GPA 2.5 or higher. GED, recent GED graduates with scores 150 or higher are also eligible. They must enroll within 6 months of completing high school or their GED, and they must accept federal and state grant money that they are awarded. There are conditions for continuing to receive the award beyond the first term or the first year. They have to maintain satisfactory academic progress. They have to maintain their enrollment status at least half time. They must annually continue to submit the FAFSA and a renewal application, and they must, I mentioned the satisfactory academic progress. They are eligible for up to 90 credit hours of funding and the potential completion of an associate degree or a program in career or technical education. Grant amounts, the legislature established a minimum grant amount of $1,000 for students whose tuition would otherwise be fully funded, is otherwise fully funded by the federal Pell Grant or the Opportunity Grant. There are many students for whom their tuition will not be covered by the federal or state Pell and Opportunity Grant, in which case this program steps into that gap, but it does so up to the average tuition charged at all community colleges, or the actual tuition, whichever is less. So there's a cap that's established for the state grant award at the average. So students attending more expensive than average colleges will have a little bit of unmet tuition if they don't qualify for the Pell. The awards are prorated based on their enrollment. There is a minimum enrollment of 6 credit hours, and it's prorated up to the full-time award for 12 credit hour students. And under the bill, students are required to pay $50 per term as a quote-unquote copay. You've seen this chart before. It attempts to describe sort of the different funding sources. The federal dollars, those Pell Grant dollars, are in green. As you look from left to right here, these are students with higher levels of expected family contributions as determined by the FAFSA on the right. So it moves from $0 EFC up to, on this graph, $8,300, but you could draw this really up to infinity since there's no limit on what that FAFSA can establish as the expected family contribution for very affluent families. The blue, the sort of primary blue here, is the Oregon Promise Grant. And you can see the relationship, again, between the federal funding and the Oregon Promise Grant. We've drawn the line here at the average tuition and fees. This actually should probably be updated to reflect our precise average. It's within $100 of what's indicated on the chart here. And then the orange line, just for sort of perspective, is an estimated annual gross income for the family whose student is adjusted gross income for the family whose student is participating in the program. There's not a direct relationship or a precise relationship between AGI and EFC, but this sort of attempts to give you a sense of what AGI would be for families with these kinds of EFCs. Again, I'm moving very quickly because you've seen most of this before. We opened the application window November 1st. Students submitted a FAFSA, or if they were not eligible to complete a FAFSA, an alternative process to establish their level of need. They submitted their high school transcripts, and we closed the primary Oregon Promise application window in March, but we continued to accept the high school transcripts and FAFSAs really up even through the last few weeks through August, as we continued to reach out to students who had submitted their Oregon Promise application, but we hadn't yet seen that verification of their 2.5 GPA. We hadn't yet seen their FAFSA come through. We continually reminded them, hey, get that stuff in so we can make you eligible for the award. Some of the materials that we put together, online fact pages, toolkits that went to schools, mm-hmm. That explained the program, tried to, in a compelling yet accurate way, describe the conditions of the program and encourage them to apply. Here's an updated version of kind of our application funnel, if you will, that contains our most recent numbers. So we had almost 20,000 Oregon Promise applications submitted, and they came from, as you can imagine, sort of all walks of life, including people who just weren't eligible kind of on the face of it. 14,000 we reviewed as potentially eligible, meaning that they had the 2.5 GPA. They were Oregon residents, graduated high school recently. We're close to about 11,000 now who submitted a valid FAFSA to the feds, and those then get shared with us. No rejections there. And then 10,459 of those who listed at least one Oregon Community College on the FAFSA. So that's sort of our pool, we think, of potential enrollees this fall who would be eligible for the program. I want to note that turning that 10,459 eligible students into actual enrollees is something that we care very much about, because the goal isn't merely to qualify people for funding. It's to actually get them to enroll and to mm-hmm. succeed. So along with this program and through the great work of our Office of Student Access and Completion, OSAC, we've created a e-mentoring program. This is in partnership with colleges in some cases and our own staff and volunteers in others. Students who agreed in their Oregon Promise application to provide a cell phone number and receive text messages from us are getting, thousands of those students are getting text messages from us or from colleges, reminding them of the deadlines, connecting them with e-mentors, ensuring that they do take the steps that they need to actually turn this intent into success. So over 7,000 text messages, over 7,000 students here received text messages. Over 3,000 of them asked for an e-mentor. Again, there's continuing follow-up with those students to try to ensure that they actually understand the award and what it will take for them to earn it and receive it at a community college this fall and on an ongoing basis. We can continue to use that that service to support those students, reminding them of their need to fill out a FAFSA for next year. You know, again, some of the very basic steps that students will need to undertake in order to maintain eligibility for the program. Cost projections. You're aware that $10 million of state funding was appropriated for the program. These assumptions are based on all of the 10,459 enrolling full-time, meaning 12 credit hours for all three terms with no attrition. So this is the very most expensive version of the program. So these are assumptions that we don't expect to come true, right? Not all 10,459 students will choose to enroll in a community college this fall. Not all of those who enroll will attend full time, and not all of those who enroll will stay enrolled for an entire year. But at its very most expensive, if every single one of those applicants turned into a full time enrollee for the year, there would be about $34 million of tuition costs associated with this program with those students. Pell, we
expect. Is that 1 year or 2 years?
That's in 1 year, in the 2016-17 year. The Pell Grant, based on what we know about those students' need and eligibility for Pell, would cover about $17 million of that total tuition cost. So about half of their tuition would be paid for by the feds. The Oregon Opportunity Grant would cover about $500,000. Student copays, that $50 a term, would cover almost $1 million. And the Oregon Promise would need to then fill out the remainder of about $16 million. I've noted here that the Pell Grant, because it exceeds the cost of tuition at community colleges, also helps to cover for low-income students' costs of attendance. The Oregon Opportunity Grant primarily covers other costs of attendance, books, transportation, potentially housing, et cetera, because it comes on top of the Pell Grant. Generally, students who receive the Opportunity Grant are also Pell Grant eligible. The student copays, some of those will cover other costs of attendance. And keep in mind, the Oregon Promise will also, for many students, help to support their cost of attendance because they are Pell Grant eligible and they're receiving the $1,000 award. So this is a sort of, again, at its very most expensive. Now, to be clear, we didn't receive a $16 million appropriation. We received a $10 million appropriation. So this would be a program that we would not be able to afford to administer if every single student showed up. That said, we don't expect, as I said, we don't expect that all 10,459 applicants will enroll, attend full-time, and attend for all three terms. Based on historic pickup rates, plus the likelihood I described, we think that this will translate into a less than $10 million program for this year, but we'll know a lot more in about 5 weeks after that fall census comes through. This, again, is a reminder. Some of you are very engaged in understanding sort of the ongoing costs of this program, and I don't want to walk through the complexity here, but the takeaway is that this program, which we put $10 million in for the current biennium, would require $40 million in the next biennium to maintain on the same terms and conditions. So no expansion if the $10 million is about the right amount, which we continue to think it is, to operate the existing program. No modifications. We believe it would cost roughly $40 million to continue in the next biennium. Because of the way the bill was drafted and passed, the current service level budget for this program is actually $20 million, not $10. I think that's could be, I've characterized that as sort of a fluke or a quirk, but it does mean that we are coming to, we've gone at this point to the governor's office and said, look, we think if you want to continue this, it's going to require a new investment, an additional investment of $20 million over and above the CSL budget. I've got some technical details in the slide, just more sort of details about the programs itself, but I will stop here, see where the commission's or the committee's interests and questions reside.
Yes, Representative.
Quick question on the fine print, if you will. If a student is enrolled, one of the 10,000 get enrolled and going through the program, and for some reason aren't able to continue their program at the end of a term or whatever, is there any look back on this, or once they quit that program, do they have any liability for the Oregon Promise?
Representative Hayden, Chair Gallegos, that's a great question. So they do not become liable to cover the costs or repay the state, if you will, for any grants they've received. So there's no risk to the student that someone will come after their money for a term that they took and got state funding for, number one. But importantly, they're maintaining continuous enrollment is a condition of continuing to receive the grant. So a student who stops out for more than a term a year, mm-hmm. essentially, and summer term is sort of that fourth term, there's not an expectation, to be very clear, there's not an expectation that students are enrolled year-round, meaning mm-hmm. four terms. But a student who doesn't maintain enrollment at least three terms will be at risk, will likely not be eligible for funding in the following term, the following year. So that's that continuous enrollment, continuous at least part-time enrollment is a requirement for continuing to receive funding under the program.
So just quick follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. So just to be clear, there is no risk to the student. You're only talking about future opportunities for them if they didn't, for whatever reason, keep the continuous or keep the GPA or whatever.
Representative Hayden, Chair Gallegos, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Cannon, thanks for your presentation and on this. Do you keep statistics on how many applications come in via FAFSA and how many come in via ORSAA?
Representative Nierman, Chair Gallegos, yes, we do, and I can give you that number within a couple of dozen. So I don't have it precisely in front of us. The vast majority of the applications we received this year came via the FAFSA or came with a FAFSA. Somewhere between 100 and 150 at this point came via the ORSA, so a very small number of the total. Part of the reason for that is that we had some technical challenges with the vendor that we used to create an alternative to the FAFSA, and that resulted in students finding some challenges, we think, in completing it. We hope that, assuming that this program continues and does so under the same terms, that we'll have a smoother enrollment process for students who complete the ORSA.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannon, does the money go to the institution or to the student? Does the student handle the money or does it go to the institution?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Gallegos. So the money is handled in precisely the same way that Oregon Opportunity Grant dollars are handled, which is that our relationship, the sort of fiscal relationship, is with the institution. But the institution then is responsible for sort of putting the dollars in the student account. And they really are the student's dollars. The institution doesn't have discretion under our agreements with the institutions to take these dollars and use them in some entirely different way. They are student dollars, but they are technically, fiscally awarded to the institution, who then applies them to specific student accounts. And this is a very customary and conventional way of handling financial aid in higher education.
A couple of quick ones. What's the total Oregon? What did we give you for the total opportunity grant money?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Gallegos, about $140 million for the biennium.
Okay, and the other question is, I didn't understand why you showed 0.5 million coming out of the opportunity grant. Second one down the second layer there.
Representative Wisnett, Chair Gallegos, yeah, it's a good question. So, again, the Oregon Promise requires students to accept all federal and state need-based aid, the Pell and the Opportunity Grant. Those Opportunity Grant, we expected about $11 million of Opportunity Grant funding will go to these students. Part of your question may be, why only $11 million out of the $140 million for the Opportunity Grant total? The answer for that is this is a fairly small slice of total higher education students in Oregon. It's only community colleges, and it's only direct from high school or GED students. And then the additional part of your question may be, why only $500,000 of this Oregon Opportunity Grant towards tuition? And the reason for that is really best illustrated, I think, by this graph, which shows that our Opportunity Grant dollars, because it's a need-based program, are focused on the lowest-income students who are likely, almost certainly, also Pell Grant recipients. Their Pell Grant will cover the cost of their tuition at any community college in the state, meaning that up to $2,100 Opportunity Grant award can support their living expenses, their other costs of attendance. And that's how we came up with this sort of $500,000 estimate around tuition, but 10.6 towards other
final
costs.
Final question,
of attendance.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
I think the sponsors of the bill and all the people that are supporting this bill are concerned about what's going to happen here. The $40 million now we're looking at instead of $10 million. And how that's going to go with the Opportunity Grant. The Ways and Means process and the executive branch can, you know, reduce the Opportunity Grant to take care of that. Are you, the sponsors of that bill, concerned, or is they talking to the executive branch or the Ways and Means chairs about that possibility?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Gallegos, we have decades of administering the Oregon Opportunity Grant for Oregon's neediest students. We think it is a vital part of how we make higher education more affordable. My commission, has been very clear from even before Senate Bill 81 was passed that maintaining or enhancing investments in the Opportunity Grant was its highest priority relative to college affordability. We were fortunate in 2015 that the legislature saw fit to invest, to make a pretty significant increase in investment to the Opportunity Grant. In fact, a larger increase to the Opportunity Grant than the $10 million of new funding that it put into the Oregon Promise. So I think I can pretty safely say on behalf of our commission that we would be deeply concerned if the Oregon Opportunity Grant was cut in order to continue funding the Oregon Promise. That said, we know we're entering a difficult budget, or likely entering a difficult budget environment in 2017, and you all will have some very difficult choices to make.
Thank you for comments.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Ben, for being here. Great presentation. I just have to get one other housekeeping question out of the order first. How is life in the post-Dana Richardson world for you?
Very difficult.
Thank you for your candor. We thought it might be. Yesterday on the way down here, I had a really, really rewarding time. I got to address the 250 Oregon Promise students at Mount Hood Community College, where they had their orientation event for them, and it was really remarkable. The level of excitement that was there. I just asked for a show of hands on how many students are here only because of the Oregon Promise, and I would say about half the kids in the room raised their hands. So it really made me feel good to be able to have a part in that. And I was really especially encouraged to see the support materials that the college has available specifically for those Oregon Promise kids. And I've got a flyer. I'll go grab it after, and I'll pass it around to the committee just to see how the college is ready for these kids, because they want them not just to, you know, this isn't just about getting them enrolled. It's about getting them to completion. So that has to be obviously job number one. So I guess my question is, as we go forward, and if Bob Brewer here, maybe he could answer this too, but have we learned, I guess, as we go through this award cycle and the average awards and so forth, and you touched on this, but I'm just guessing, as we look at the next budget cycle, we're pretty confident that $10 million will be a number on an annual basis for a cohort, if you will, going forward as we build that budget for the next biennium. Because the other thing I would say is that I think there still is low-hanging fruit, I guess, or
there still is, has been a somewhat of a lack of awareness on the part of some families and some students in this cohort that just missed the deadline, didn't quite get, you know, the high school didn't quite communicate as clearly as they could have. I think the number will go up next year. It won't go down. So I just, again, going forward, I want to make sure that whatever that number is going to be sufficient to meet demand. But I guess as we look at what the average award is, who's the average Oregon Promise student, and do the extrapolation to make sure that we're going to have, make an ask that's going to be sufficient to meet demand, because, you know, this can't be a one-off. We've got to do this well.
Representative Johnson, Chair Gallegos, thanks for the comments and the question. This business of projecting the cost of this program is very, very challenging. And here we are, September 21st, with the term starting at most community colleges next week, and we still don't really know what it's going to cost this year, because student decisions are made first week, second week of the term, and then, by the way, they'll be making decisions again for the winter term, and we don't know how many of those students will choose to continue or at what level they will be enrolled. That said, we've looked at Tennessee, we've looked at prior cohorts of direct from high school students, and we are reasonably confident that the $10 million will be sufficient to administer the program. We've looked at the level of need and the amount of federal dollars that they'll be bringing in. I think your point about the potential growth of interest in and participation in the program is an important one. We haven't spent a lot of time on that question yet. We've been so focused on getting ready for this year, that the question of what would this look like in 2017 is we're only beginning to ask. But we will have the advantage 6 months from now, when you're in session making these decisions, of being able to compare our application rates for the second year of the program with our application rates for the first year of the program, right? So we'll have a little bit of history to draw from. So we'll be creating versions of this for the second cohort, and can see whether there appears to be a significant or any kind of uptick in enrollment. $10 million may not be enough, and we'll be watching that closely in the months to come.
Thank you.
One more?
Just real quick. I think one of the things that hasn't come up, and I'd see if you've thought about it at all, but and I know you have, but is the role of counselors in all of this decision making, and starting at the lowest at high school, working on through the colleges, and really thinking about they're the ones that can help those students understand what, you know, help them identify their own goals, but also get that FAFSA form filled out correctly, get it turned in, and really hold one-to-one. And we've got a real challenge, because the ratio for counselors to students should be around 250-1, and I think it's over 600-1 in the state of Oregon. So something to work on there. I just mentioned it because I think it's a real important foundation for this whole program.
Exactly.
Is we've got to have good counseling services. So you'll be hearing more. I don't know if you wanted to chime in on that, but hopefully we'd have your support for getting more and better qualified counselors in our schools.
Representative Reardon, Chair Gallegos, yes, and I would only probably broaden the point to include counselors and advisors in post-secondary as well. If the goal of the program, as I think it is to ensure access and success, then providing these students with a level of support once they reach their community college to get in the courses that they need to get on a path towards a certificate or degree is also very key. And we, again, appreciate the decision of the legislature to put some additional funding into community colleges for academic advisors specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Cannon. Representative McEwen has a question.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gaines. I think Representative Johnson, one of us would be very comfortable stepping forward and flagging support for programs that we already have in the state that augment that high school counselor-student relationship. We have the Aspire program, which is administered through the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, serving over 100 high schools that support the high school counseling mm-hmm. staff in doing this work. The AVID program that we've just been talking about in the last session that is moving forward at the high school and at the college institutional level. We have other programs that partner with those. There's College Dreams. There's a number of them around the state that are doing that work in response to that student-counselor ratio that we identified well over a decade and a half ago that is inadequate. So we've been in this ball game for a very long time and not providing the robust support that our students need in making good decisions on not only what their path is, but how to be good consumers along the way. Yep, yep. So I think it would just be remiss if we didn't call out the fact that we do have state-funded programs that are doing this work. The ultimate goal would be to get to that 250 student counselor ratio, but we're not there. We haven't been there for a very long time, and to get there would be a transformation in the system. But we do have people out there that are doing very good work to assure that our students do have some of those resources that they need.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Representative Hayden, you had a question.
Thank you, Chair Gallegos.
Looking forward, and as we track this data, do you have an anticipation of the, I believe it was $17.4 million estimated from the Pell Grant? I know you probably don't know now, but do you have anticipation to be able to track what wouldn't have been provided under the Pell Grant without this program, without the Oregon Promise?
Representative Hayden, Chair Gallegos, if I understand your question, and it's one that's interested our commission as well, and let me re-ask it and get a nod from you if I'm on the right track. To what extent is this program bringing in federal dollars that weren't coming in before?
Correct.
Right. And yes. So, and I think this is really critical, not just on the, and it relates to leveraging federal dollars. It also simply relates to, are more students going to community college?
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
And that is really the key question, right? If we want to see, we are very hopeful that we will see an increase in direct from high school or direct from GED enrollment at community college, that along with that will be an infusion of new federal resources into the state through the Pell Grant program, and we will be watching that very, very closely. It is too early to say. We've sort of anecdotally surveyed the community colleges about their enrollment for fall. They're starting to get a sense of that. It seems to be kind of all over the board right now, and it is, as I said, it's still early, but there are certainly some colleges, maybe many, if not most, that are seeing significant increases, at least at the outset, in their direct from high school enrollment.
Wow. Obviously, this is an important program for the legislature. We're very excited by it and appreciate all the work that you and your staff are putting into it. I do have a couple of questions myself. And I guess what I appreciate really, I think 40-40-20, you know, and what the whole picture looks like. And so this discussion about transition, I think, is a really important one. Making sure we have the staffing, the counseling, the support system in order to get our students recruited into higher education or trades, et cetera. And my question really probably gets at more of a workforce issue. I mean, we can talk about Oregon Promise as getting our students into the system, but I'm also interested in getting them out of the system. And, for example, I know that we do have some other non-academic kinds of programs. So, for example, there's a program at Portland State around childcare. And apparently those students in that program actually take as many courses and complete as many hours as they would in terms of getting a bachelor's degree. Is the heck at all interested in helping to look at that issue in terms of transition of credits and and maybe certifying that at an equal kind of level?
Representative Gallegos, yes. And I think those types of workforce training opportunities are critically important. And when we think about affordability, we should think about it not merely in terms of, or not merely for students who are seeking associate's degrees for transfer or four-year degrees at public universities, but for students who are enrolled in training programs that lead to certificates or potentially may not even not lead to certificate, but are providing training in skills that are related to jobs. To be clear, this program, as adopted by the legislature, does support the tuition costs at for students enrolled in community college programs that are career and technical education leading to a certificate. So many of the types of students at community college who are there primarily for learning a trade, as long as it is results in a certificate, are eligible for this program.
And I just want to maybe point out also, this committee spends a lot of time talking about high-end salaries. You know, how do we get a workforce that's going to get engineering or medical degrees and so on? And I just want to make sure that we're also concerned about what I would call our underpaid workforce, and that's child care or working with developmentally those kinds of folks, those workers, and certification requirements that we can sort of help with. One final comment I would have, did you have a comment? I just want to say, see if those e-mentors are available to us at all as legislators. I think that's a great idea. Did you have something?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to pass out for the committee to see what the document that Mounted Community College had for their Oregon Promise orientation yesterday, just to show how they're alerting students to all the various support services necessary and where to find them, which I thought was really, really
awesome.
Good. I'm hoping we can replicate that at all of our colleges, but
I'd post this on the
yeah, it'd be perfect. You could do that. Thanks for
great. Well, thank you again.
Thank you very
much,
Mr. Chair. We'd be happy to provide you with an e-mentor. Just talk to Colin here,
okay.
We'll hook you
awesome.
Up. Thank you.
Yeah. We'll close the hearing then on Oregon Promise and open a hearing on healthcare workforce in Southern Oregon, which is kind of fitting since we ended up talking about workforce.
We're actually moving from HEC to AHEC.
What the heck? It's AHEC or AHEC?
AHEC.
AHEC.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Chris Guastafaro. I'm the executive director of Area Health Education Center of Southwest Oregon. If you're not familiar with AHEC, our primary role, or one of our primary roles, is to solve urgent healthcare workforce issues by building healthcare supply pipelines, high school, postgraduate, and currently now we're working on residency programs with the GME consortium. Specifically in rural area. I'm here actually today to represent the leadership committee for the Regional Allied Health College in Southern Oregon, specifically in Roseburg. So we have been peeling away an onion and plotting points on a pathway. And so today I'd like to give vision, maybe state some of the issues, some of the data, maybe what a perfect world would look like in Douglas County pertaining to healthcare and some potential solutions. The objective, however, is to show a focus or have a focus on the particular needs of for an increased allied health workforce in rural Oregon. The community is working together to create an economic engine that produces some gargantuan returns in finance and social capital. But on May 23rd, 2016, the House Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development Committee heard testimony from a consortium of individuals and organizations working to establish a Regional Allied Health College in Southern Oregon. So today is kind of part B of that discussion. Some of the questions were asked about the capacity of the state's current allied health training programs. The short answer is simply, without an allied health college in Southern Oregon, we will ultimately fail to meet the growing health care needs of our communities, including the seniors and veterans. You assuredly know that healthcare is a major sector in Oregon's economy. With 174,000 jobs, healthcare employment makes about 10% of Oregon's labor market. It is among the few industries that grew during the recession. It is also evident that Oregon's healthcare workforce contributes close to $23 billion in the GDP, 14% of the state's job market. Specifically, Allied Health is a huge contributor to the majority of that growth, and that is where the discussion lies today. So before you, you have some data points on some of the specific growth needs for Allied and mental health workforce demand. Again, a snapshot in time right now, but projections for the next 10 years. We have, these are the newest data sets that have come out from the Oregon Employment Department. However, these are very conservative. So some of the anecdotal and some of the research that is going on with the Oregon Nursing Consortium has found that these numbers are very low, and we need to be prepared for an influx, actually an exodus of workforce and more allied health care. Familiar with allied healthcare professionals, including dental hygienists, diagnostic medical sonographers, dietitians, medical technologists, etc. These are the support systems for our primary care. We're finding that there's a direct correlation in evidence that the need for physician assistants and nurse practitioners grow, the demand for allied health in Oregon, specifically rural Oregon, is increased as well. And this has put a strain and will continue to put a strain on the rural healthcare workforce. Simply, Oregon has become the great exporters of students in out of high school and postgraduate school from rural areas, and it puts a tremendous burden on the healthcare centers, clinics, critical access hospitals to come up with a tremendous amount of money to recruit and retrain or retain physicians as well as allied healthcare workforce. And so we need a solution. And one of the solutions, which I believe very strongly in, is to create a school, more institutions, educational institutions in rural areas, a model specifically in Roseburg, to help fill these positions. There's a dire need to have more advanced healthcare education institutions, very similar to the model in Lebanon, Oregon, the Western Comp. The one promising example that could be scaled to the rest of the state eventually is the proposed regional allied health college in Roseburg. In this particular instance, local businesses, government, health organizations, along with the VA, are working together to increase the economic vitality as well as the community through a robust project that will meet or exceed the healthcare workforce and that will extend beyond the Douglas County area and into the other Southern Oregon areas. We believe strongly that an allied health college will add significant economic and social capital to a rural community, and through a very important economic impact study, they found that this solution would be a stable economic engine in this area, creating many jobs as well as money back into the community. So The purpose of today was to share some of these findings with these recent data, and to show that there to continue to show that there is an increased need for an allied health medical institute in rural Oregon.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Any questions from the committee? Yes.
Thank you, Chris, for coming in. Just a clarification, if you would.
Sure.
We have this chart.
Yes.
These appear to be statewide.
No. These are statewide, yes.
Okay. So are you eventually going to break that down for the area?
Yeah, in fact, I do have similar statistics for or data sets for Southern Oregon. For instance, registered nurses, total openings within the next 10 years are approximately 2,300, with a growth of 15%. An average of all of these allied health positions is around 18% growth. This shows about 21% growth need for the state. Southern Oregon is more of an 18% growth for the state for all of the allied health needs. But I do have specific breakouts that I can
those to the committee.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can do that.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Very helpful. Thank you. With that, we'll close the hearing on allied health in Southwest Oregon, and open the hearing on former foster youth. Right on cue. Look at that. Senator Dembro, Neil Nagus, Foster Success Program.
Why don't I start it off, and then I will yield.
Can you give us your name, please?
Sure. Hello, Chair Gallegos and committee members. Pleasure to see you. I'm Senator Michael Dembro, represent District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I'm here just to kick off a conversation about foster youth and some initiatives that are underway. Some of the challenges that foster youth face, former foster youth, when they start college and university. Some of you may remember, I'm staring at Representative Johnson, I think he's the only one that was on this committee in 2011, when we passed what came to be known as the Foster Youth Promise. That was our first promise. This was the Foster Youth Promise back in 2011. And it recognized the very low graduation rate among former foster youth who attend our community colleges and universities. In fact, at the time, the success rate was about 2% of all foster youth who were getting bachelor's degrees. And we recognized that that was something that we had to change, that that was just perpetuating cycles of fosterhood. And so I, at the time, partnered with the then chair of the Education Committee, Matt Wingard, to create this program, the Foster Youth Promise, which gave former foster youth tuition waivers for attending community colleges and universities in order to do two things. First of all, to recognize our responsibilities as a state acting as, you know, the parents of these children. They were our responsibilities. They're the warts of the state. To try to remove barriers to their coming to college and being successful. And that has been a success, although one of the things that I'm asking the the heck to do is to give us good numbers on where the different colleges and universities are in terms of their foster former foster youths attending, and then their success rates. But we believe that it's making a difference. There was one other component of the legislation that was more it was something that we were hoping would see happen, and that was that on the different college campuses, college university campuses, we would see foster centers, foster youth centers, where former foster youth could come together for mutual support. So in a sense, they would be paying back for, you know, they're giving, being given free tuition. In exchange, they would be contributing through supporting each other, upper class persons supporting lower class persons, serving as mentors perhaps to high school kids, show them that there's a path for them. And that's an aspect that has been kind of spotty among the campuses. What you're going to hear about after I stop talking at you is about a program that is getting underway at Portland Community College and one that is getting underway at Western Oregon University. There's been a strong sentiment of support for tackling the foster youth challenge at both of those institutions, and some very interesting things that I hope we can perpetuate and actually expand around the state.
Great.
So with that, unless anybody has any questions about that original bill, I'd be happy to answer them or turn things over.
I believe Representative McEwen has a question.
This will be no surprise to Vice Chair Gallegos. Thank you for your work on this, Senator Dembrough. This is such an important issue. And as a state, I think we've done a reasonable job, but there's always more to do. Just making certain that those students are applying for the Chafee Grant or even know that the Chafee Grant is there is something that we've always struggled with, that there are resources through the Independent Living Program that, that are coordinated, that those students have access to, that if they don't know it, we're not doing our job. And I just really want to thank you for your work on this. It's really incredibly important, and it's a segment of the population that I think we need to feel good about the work that we're doing to support them through. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
One quick follow-up.
Oh, yeah, one quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dembrough, could you quantify spotty? Because I haven't been following this a great deal either since 2011. What do we know about the way that the bill that we passed in 11 has been, you know, implemented? How it has impacted kids across the state? You're going to talk about PCC, which sounds like they've got something going, but what do we know about other post-secondary?
Well, I think we just, thanks, Chair Gallegos and Rep. Johnson. I don't know the details of how it is, but I know that it is part of the admissions process that people identify themselves as former foster youth, and then there's, you know, an investigation to see, yes, are they indeed former foster youth, and then they receive the tuition waiver.
Okay.
Now, I will say that many, if not most, of the students are also getting Pell Grants and Oregon Opportunity Grants because they tend to be low income. And so for those who are in the community college, those scholarship programs actually cover right. virtually all of the tuition. For the universities, it was always much more of a stretch for the universities to step up and make this commitment. But my understanding is that, you know, they have made the commitment, they're following through. There could be a concern down the road if we are able, as we hope, to really ramp up the number of foster youth who enter our college and university system. It will be more of a struggle for them, you know, to absorb that cost at the university level. But, you know, I think that's a challenge that we're hoping we're going to face.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Gagos, I want to flag this just one more time, and I'm not hearing Chafee in the words that you're saying when we're talking about opportunity and Pell,
right.
And the schools stepping up. But I just got word just 5 minutes ago that the Chafee grant has gone back up to the original amount of $5,000 a year for former foster youth.
Yeah.
They've ramped it back up again. It's a really critical piece, particularly at the university level when the costs are higher, that those kids get in the queue to apply for Chafee. And a lot of times folks aren't aware of it. So
yeah.
Awareness in our financial aid offices is very important in an area that can help a great deal.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that, Rep. McEwen. You know, the foster youth promise focuses on the tuition side, as does the, you know, largely the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Pell Grant. But the Chafee really helps with housing and some of the other living expenses. We all know that the tuition is just one part of the challenge that former foster youth, as all students, face. They also have challenges just when life happens and something, you know, of an emergency nature comes up. Ideally, you know, if you're part of a family, you can look to your family for help with those emergencies. Many of these students, if not most of these students, don't have that, and they really struggle. Yeah, and I think you'll hear more about that.
Thank you, Senator.
Great.
With our panel coming up, I don't want to pressure you. We usually would quit at 10, but we can go after. We can stay, and if some of the representatives need to leave, then that's okay too. But we'll be, those of us that can stay will stay. So.
Thank you, Chair Gallegos, and members of the committee, and we'll try to be very brief. For the record, my name is Neil Nagus, and I am the Assistant to the Executive Director at the Portland Community College Climb Center for Advancement. And I think you have some of my testimony in front of you, so I'll just be brief and just kind of cover the highlights. As Senator Denbrough mentioned, at community college, many of the students, or almost all the foster youth students, don't access the tuition waiver. But they have other needs, and finances don't necessarily cover those. And as Senator also mentioned, only 2 or 3% of all foster youth that attend college actually ever complete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so tuition is not the only answer. They need additional support services at the college. And that's what we're trying to accomplish at Portland Community College. We've also established a fund in our foundation so we can now get donations for the program, but not only for the program, but for the emergencies, so that we have students. For example, we had a student last semester who was doing well, needed a root canal. I needed $500 for root canal, couldn't go to class because of the pain, and she didn't have $500. We were able to find some pro bono work to help, but those are the kinds of issues that derail many of these students, and so we're trying to create some kind of a support fund for those students. In addition, the main thing that we're working on is establishing a support network within the college and with our community partners, the Independent Living Program coordinators and the Department of Human Services. And the idea is to integrate into the fabric of Portland Community College support for foster youth. We already have a lot of support services, and now we have identified champions at all our campuses in various departments, such as financial aid, advising, counseling, and those individuals have essentially volunteered their time to work more closely with foster youth, and we are now developing training so that those individuals learn more about the issues and the barriers that face foster youth in a more sensitive situation. They will receive this logo, and this is sort of will be on their offices and their desks, so that when foster youth see this, and I think Western Oregon is also using a similar logo, they'll know that this is a safe place and a place where they can go and talk to somebody that is more aware and sensitive of their needs. And also, I think it was mentioned about identifying the students that are attending college that come out of care. And that's very, very challenging. We really don't have the figures or the mechanism of identifying those students unless they self-disclose. But at Portland Community College, we now have on our application a checkbox where students can voluntarily check whether or not they're in care or have previously been in care. And for the fall term, again, voluntarily, 240 students have checked that box. So we now have a way of identifying at least 240 students and reaching out to them. And we're also trying to establish a club of foster youth, as Senator Dembro mentioned, also to provide peer support and also outreach to other students that they can indicate that now at PCC is a support network and other foster youth that are there to provide support to foster youth that are entering into the college. We also had, for the first time last month, a foster day at our Cascade campus, where we invited foster youth who will be attending PCC in the fall to attend and meet people, get oriented to the college, mm-hmm. learn about how to navigate the college. And we had 20 foster youth that were referred from the independent living programs around the district. And our feedback from that was very helpful, not only for the students, but for our community partners as well who are working with the students so that they now have contacts at the college and ways that they can better support their students when they come to PCC. We've also been creating partnerships with Western Oregon University and Portland State University to help create a pathways for students that once they complete PCC, they can move on to a four-year school. And we're really hoping that ultimately this supports statewide for a statewide initiative for all state community state colleges and universities to have support for foster youth as they do in California and in Washington and some other states. So now I would like to introduce Lisa Phoenix, who is we've been able to fortunately receive only a 10-month grant, but it's a grant to hire a coordinator for our fostering success program. And Lisa?
Yeah, so I'm Dr. Lisa Phoenix. I have a PhD in neurobiology and behavior from the University of Washington up in Seattle. I am a former foster youth, and I represent a very rare statistic of individuals who left the system and were successful. But my journey was like many other foster youth. So I was a ward of the state from age 6. There was a brief break, and then I went back as ward of the state at age 8. And I was in the system until I was 16, and I ran away, almost 16, because my home life had been quite abusive and neglectful. My mother was severely mentally ill, had a very abusive father who left when I was 5. We represented a demographic that's very common for foster youth. Unfortunately, I entered foster care and went through a series of also abusive foster homes. Not always real physical abuse, but neglect. There was a lot of drug use. You know, often when you come from these environments, you start out at the bottom, and the bottom's there for you. So, you know, I was surrounded by a lot of, you know, meth dealers. You know, even in foster care, there were foster parents whose kids were all in and out of prison. There was drug dealing going on out of the house. So you're pulled out of the home, and you're kind of put into this environment. So by the time I was almost 16, I was very tired of that. And I ran away. And, you know, I just want to credit how much federal and state both funding and legislation has changed. For me, back then, there was nothing that happened. I was actually emancipated without my knowledge at age 16. I was pregnant by then, had a daughter at 17. I was a dropout. I had learning disabilities, as many kids coming out of these environments have. And I never imagined in my life that I would go to college. My daughter was actually the factor that changed that for me, because I had her and I couldn't imagine creating for her the same generational pattern that had been going on for forever. My mother's mother was also mentally ill, and she had an even worse childhood than me. These are things that go on, you know, they stay generational. And so I wanted to make a change for my daughter, so I got my GED. And at 18, I started college like everybody else. But it was so hard. So with learning disabilities, you need support. Poverty, you need support. I didn't fit in. Normally I talk about this better. I don't know why I'm having a hard time today, but I didn't fit in. I had trust issues, had difficulty accessing, I had difficulty accessing supports because I couldn't trust anybody. So I just felt like, even though I got into college, that failure was written all over my future. And I'm an incredibly stubborn individual, and my daughter remained a motivating force for me not to give up. And that's, weirdly, you know, it was a lot of pressure trying to go to school as a full-time student, raising a baby by myself, completely unprepared, no family support, no one I could borrow money from, I could get childcare from. So you make a lot of high-risk decisions to keep that going. We were homeless for a while. We lived in a tent, but I kept going to school. Not every foster youth has whatever genes or whatever I got. I can't even explain what I got. And they're not going to be able to do all the stuff that I did. I used to hitchhike to school with a baby in a backpack because the bus didn't run some of the hours I needed to take classes. I don't want other foster youth to have to make those decisions. I did it, and I went on, and I managed to get a PhD, and I managed to become very successful. And my greatest success is that my daughter, who's 32 now, is a social worker. So she, you know, she has her MSW, and I broke. You know, we're both taxpayers. We both are not in prison, right? We are not addicted to drugs and alcohol, all the stuff that would have been written in my future. We were able to change that. So the thing is, I succeeded in helping, you know, break something that just went on and on and on. So this is the power. I'm coming from support programs in Michigan, which has very successful support programs for foster youth. They are well funded because part of it is providing that high contact support where you give foster youth time to trust and build the relationship. Sometimes just having the supports there don't work because you first have to bridge all of those barriers that they have. I had aggression problems, I had temper problems, I had all kinds of stuff that would be normal given where I was coming from, but were huge barriers to integrating to the college campus. And I really never felt like I belonged. Even now, sometimes when I hang out with other PhDs, I still feel like I don't belong. You know, So whatever we can do to support these programs and to benchmark against other programs that are highly successful, I just the value, I'm proof of the value of supporting foster youth to break those patterns. And it's not easy. I work with foster youth. I see their barriers and I watch them in play every day. And sometimes all I'm doing is trying to raise insight. So I think I talked too long, but thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Good morning. My name is Karen Sullivan Vance. I'm the director of the Academic Advising and Learning Center at Western Oregon University. I'm also one of the co-chairs of the Fostering Collegiate Success Initiative at Western, along with Dr. Emily Pleck from Communication Studies and Shannon Simage from Polk County Youth Services. And we have developed this initiative with the help from DHS, with a grant from them, to support our foster youth on our campus. And it's really a three-pronged process. So part of it is we've developed a web page for them that lists academic and career support resources, community resources, internships, jobs, that sort of thing. Also, our Wills Fostering Hope student club that they can become involved in. And on top of that, peer mentoring that we're looking to hopefully put into place this year so that foster youth can mentor each other. One of the other factions that we've worked at is training. Faculty and staff on campus, for the most part, unless they have been involved in the foster care system, are really ignorant about it. They're unaware of the challenges that Lisa would have experienced. They're also unaware of some of the issues that can come up in a classroom setting. So we are doing training. We brought in someone from Western Michigan to do our training at the Dream Conference this summer. Dr. Pluck today is actually doing training with faculty, getting them to be aware that on their syllabi, if they're doing an assignment that revolves around family of origin, that may trigger all sorts of issues for students, so getting them to think about that. We have 32 faculty and staff who have volunteered to be foster youth liaisons on our campus, working, and we hope we're going to increase that even more. And then the third part of our initiative is that pathways piece that Neil was talking about. It's important to us that students not only access education, whether that be a certificate program, a four-year degree, a postgraduate degree, but that they actually transition into and through. We want to get them to degree completion and to provide those wraparound services that will help them. And I just want to say, once again, we're very grateful to DHS because they gave us the little bump that we needed to be able to get launched. And we will look at all different resources in the future to try and build our program. So thank you.
Thank you all very much. Did you have someone else?
We have one more presenter. Just if we have a few minutes.
Good morning, Chair Gallegos, members of the committee. My name is Lori Price. I am a child well-being program manager at the Department of Human Services Office of Child Welfare Programs. I know we're past time. I appreciate you all staying and being so attentive to this presentation. So what I will do is just say that along with DHS's efforts to increase the rate of high school graduation for children and youth in its care, and to increase opportunities for secondary education, that it's programs like these that are so critically important in our partnership with folks like those at the table today that will help with the retention of students. So getting them into college is one thing. Helping them pay their tuition is another thing. Even assisting through CHAFE with their housing is another thing. But getting them to continue to stay and see it through to completion is where all of this really pulls together for us.
Thank you very much. Did you have a comment? No? Yes,
President. I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just don't know on this. Is there any legal or privacy impediment to DHS notifying the colleges of who is a foster student? And maybe there is, and maybe that's appropriate. But we talked about identifying these people. So is there some issue with that?
Or? We've been working very closely with many of our partners on how we appropriately share that information. Right now it is a self-disclosure by the student. We certainly don't want to label anyone. We want to make sure that our children, youth, young adults have all of the opportunities available to them and that they're informed about those opportunities. But we don't at this time currently routinely send a list. We don't have a way to match data. Right now our systems don't talk to each other. We have ongoing conversations with ESD about how to do that at all levels of education, but student IDs don't translate well to other information that we have about foster youth.
Can I say something? I think it's also a tricky issue as well because many young people who are coming out of the care system do not want to be labeled. Yeah. So oftentimes they want to eschew that. I think that's why programs like we're trying to really initiate here can allow for word of mouth so that students can then self-disclose and access those.
Thank you.
Chair Gallegos. Yes. I just have a quick question. The independent living program that the state supports, is that part of the wraparound services is integrating with the independent living program to make sure that these students have the support outside of the educational institution that they need? Are they on your radar?
It is for us. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's what Shannon Simage, who is one of the co-chairs of our program, does the independent living program for Polk County.
Okay.
So that's part of it. And then I think it's sort of branching out from that. How do we get the other ILP coordinators around the state involved as well? But yes, that's a part of it. If not all students access it, though, and not all students are necessarily told about it.
Well, and so that I'll reiterate my comment from earlier about the CHAFE program and independent living because they are wonderful financial support and just common sense support on how you live, rent an apartment, go stock your shelves is a really critical piece. But if kids don't know it's there, you can't access this, and I get very concerned that we're not making those connections for these kids for this continuum of care that can actually make them successful, not only the services that get provided on your campus with the academic support, but the rest of the support is just as important. But if you don't know it's there, you can't access it. So I just want to get that on the record that it's really critically important through DHS, through the institutions that are educational, that kids keep being educated about what resources they have.
Rep. McGowan, Chair Gallegos.
It's McEwen, but that's fine. It happens all the time.
I'm so sorry. Rep. McEwen.
Thank you.
Chair Gallegos, just a quick comment on that, and that is a fine line that DHS walks between we are educating our workers, doing constant outreach and educating our youth from ages 14 now and up about independent living programs. It's a fine line the department walks between achieving permanency, in which case a child exits our system into a permanent living situation and no longer qualifies for independent living program services, and for those that are going to stick with us through that stage. Well noted.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank the panel. I mean, such a really important work that you're doing, and our appreciation of that. I'm sorry, Doctor, your name again?
Phoenix. Lisa is fine.
Lisa.
I need the last name for the record.
I can spell it out for you.
All right. Well, I just want to acknowledge your story and appreciate your story. I think we're very fortunate in the system to have you with us. Mm-hmm. What you made me think about was sort of our work in terms of trauma-informed care, and I was thinking about intergenerational poverty and sort of the notion of intergenerational trauma, and I think you speak well to that issue.
You probably don't have time for extra reading, but I did write a book about my experiences.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
Wonderful.
I'm going to leave it over here if anyone would like to pass it around.
Thank you very much.
Because it is different. I mean, I think we identify many vulnerable populations, and we don't.
Can you bring it up?
Recorded.
Yeah. You bring it up to the.
I'm just saying, doesn't she need to be? You're not being recorded in your comments when you are not sitting at the dais.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
co-chair.
No, that's what we meant. Yeah.
Could you hold it up so we can see the book?
The colleges, particularly community colleges, have a lot of services that support college success for lots of individuals coming from what we consider these vulnerable populations, intergenerational poverty, minority groups. But I think what we need to understand is that foster youth are basically they're a tornado of all of those things together. And this is why the services, sometimes it's just not enough that we have tutoring, that we have some counselors. It's really the benchmarking against other states where they have these programs very well organized and well funded. They need additional in order to access those services. I spend a lot of time talking to youth about their barriers. Why aren't you accessing that service? Because you have a goal to get a college degree, but everything I see you doing right now is handicapping that goal. So it's kind of that support is so important. And I just, clearly I'm passionate about this issue. And I would really like to see the state of Oregon, really expand this effort and become one of the leaders in very effective support for foster youth.
We can hope so.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Thank you
for
your
time.
With that, we'll close the hearing on Secure. And I think we're
great.
Ready to adjourn? Ready to adjourn?
Great.